Welcome to this episode of My Journey as a Physicist. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interests outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 3 features physicists involved in the long-range plan for nuclear science. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I'm Bill Good, and I'm here with Kinza Hassan.
Hi, everyone. Today, we're happy to have Dr. Elena Alper with us. Thanks for joining us. To get started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I'm a nuclear physicist, and I've done experiments with proton, neutron, pion, electron, and photon beams. I was a professor at a public university, Ohio University, for 9 years, and then a professor at George Washington University, which is a private university in D.C. Then on the last 4 years that I was at GW, I was the chair of the physics department. And then in 2014, I joined the federal workforce as a program director for nuclear physics here at the National Science Foundation. One more little factoid about myself is that my daughter was born 1 month after I took and passed the PhD qualifying exam at Indiana University. So she's gone through it all with me.
Wow, that's really awesome. So could you give us a little more ideas about what kind of research you did? I don't know if you're still doing it anymore at the NSF.
Good question. So the National Science Foundation allows program directors to spend up to 20% of their time on research. But the reality is that that's hard to do for an analyst. After my last PhD student defended, my research really ramped down to zero. But I covered a lot of nuclear physics. I started with inelastic scattering of protons from stretched states in carbon-12 and oxygen-16. I've done measurements of charge symmetry breaking, pion production. And the last experiment that I was on was called Q-weak. And that's where we measured the weak mixing angle at low values of momentum transfer in parity violating elastic electron proton scattering. So that experiment was done at Jefferson Lab. It was a long time to get on the floor and get working. We took data for, I think, over 2 years, and it was another 2 years before we got the final results out. There were systematic effects that were challenging.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's interesting. Kind of the range of research you've done in the experiment. Yeah. So can you tell us what a typical day is like for you at the NSF as the program director?
So there is no, you probably hear this a lot, there is no typical day.
Yeah. The
NSF uses the peer review process to identify strong proposals, and then we provide funding to the PIs, the principal investigators, to execute those proposals. So proposals will come in to do experiments or do some theoretical calculations, and they request funding for graduate students, postdocs, perhaps equipment, travel to laboratories, and all of that is covered by taxpayer funds. But there isn't a typical day here. It's more like there's an annual cycle. So the proposals for the nuclear physics program, they're due in December. And then career proposals, that's a special program for beginning faculty, they're due in the summertime. And then proposals for major research infrastructure equipment, those are due in the fall. So every time of the year, there's something going on. But for each one of those cohorts of proposals, there's a process of identifying reviewers with the appropriate expertise, sending out the proposals to those reviewers, putting together a panel of experts that will do a comparative assessment of the cohort of proposals, and then making funding recommendations. So it's a really fascinating job because I get to read the proposals with all these great ideas that people have. So that's really exciting. And usually in the months leading up to a proposal due date, PIs will call me to give feedback on their ideas. So I can't provide guidance on how to write their proposal because that would give them an unfair advantage over the people who didn't contact me. But I can tell them if what they're proposing is in the scope of what the program funds or if it might fit better in a different program. Or how are you going to do the experiment if you don't have any equipment? Yeah, you know, so I'll ask a few general type questions and they'll go, oh, yeah. So that's basically the job. There's always something new going on. The way you get to work at NSF is two ways, really, for scientists. You can join as a federal employee like I did, but the federal employee positions don't open up very often. But one opened up in 2014, and I applied for it, and I was lucky and I got it. But there's another way that scientists can work at NSF as in the science areas, and that's to serve as a program director in positions that we call rotators. So these people, they take a leave of absence from their home institution, or they get detailed by their home institution to come to NSF. And so they serve as a program officer, a program director for anywhere from 1 to 4 years, doing the exact same jobs as I do. As soon as they walk in the door, they're fully empowered to do what a federal employee does. And this is a huge benefit to NSF because we get ideas from the community coming into the agency with ideas about the science itself, what are interesting areas of science, what are up and coming areas of science, ideas on how to make the system work better. So it's a benefit to us, and it's a benefit to the people who do it because they get to see the process from the inside. So when they go back to their home institution, they can help people write a better proposal. But they also have learned a lot while they're here. So it's a great program.
That's really awesome. So my question is, what makes one want to work for the NSF?
So when I became a Fed, it was a big decision because I knew that I would stop doing research, I would stop teaching, and I loved both of those things. But by working at the NSF, you've got a different way to have an impact on the field. So that's always been a priority at NSF, is broadening the participation of people who in groups who have not been typically included in the STEM areas. And I make a point of telling PIs who are in those groups about the programs that we have that they can apply to. I make a point of making sure that the panels that I put together to look at the cohort of proposals, that there is good representation of different groups on those panels. Because if it's always the same group of people who are doing the evaluating, the same group of people tend to get funded. And so that's one of the things that I feel strongly about and that I think I have been able to bring to the nuclear physics program that gives me a lot of satisfaction. So the proposals all have to be great, but there are other aspects. And in fact, all of the proposals that come to NSF have at least two merit review criteria. One is the intellectual merit, and the other is the broader impacts. And broader impacts are not defined by NSF. We let the PIs define what they want to, what impact they want to have that affects society in a broader way. And so that's enough. So what I'm doing is consistent with the NSF mission, and it gives me a lot of satisfaction. So that's why I wanted to come. I wanted to impact nuclear physics and have a broader impact on society.
That's really awesome. Yeah, it's definitely seems like the NSF can give you a position to do that more than just, you know, doing your research and choosing who's in your group and all that. You can really expand that impact. I was wondering how, you know, this job is different from something like a university administration position. I'm sure it's a lot, but also similar.
So it's very similar to being a department chair, because a department chair at a university, a lot of what you do as a department chair is you enable other people to do their teaching. You enable other people to do their research. You make sure that they've got the research space, that their lab is set up. You make sure that there's staff that knows how to run the machine shop, things like that. And so that's what I do, is I enable other people to do their research. And so it's similar to being a department chair. Other ways that being a program director is similar to being a department chair is that we are expected to successfully carry out the wider goals of the administration. So if the dean decides that there's going to be a restructuring of the curriculum, the department chair manages that. If the administration decides that an emphasis, a priority in science for the next couple of years is going to be artificial intelligence, we find a way to support that. So it's a mixture of helping people do their research and also doing what the policies that the higher ups decide we're going to be doing this year.
That's really interesting. So I think you mentioned the different, you know, types of proposals and stuff. Do you also look at the graduate research fellowship program proposals as well for the NSF?
So the graduate research fellowship proposals come into the agency, and the review of those is managed by the education directorate, but they always need subject matter experts. And so they always put out a call asking for program directors in physics to manage the panels in physics. And so I've participated in those. So those, the NSF-wide things like that, they always ask for subject experts. And it's important to do that sort of thing. So yeah, I've participated in that.
That's really awesome. That was just a personal curiosity.
So how would you explain to undergrad students and graduate students what your roles were in the long-range plan?
So the Nuclear Science Advisory Committee is this advisory committee that chartered and put together by DOE and NSF for the express purpose of giving us guidance and advice on what the priorities and opportunities are in nuclear science. But they don't just give their advice willy-nilly. They just don't decide, I think a new lab should be built somewhere. They don't do that. They respond to the charges that DOE and NSF put to them. So if there's a particular area of nuclear physics or nuclear chemistry or whatever that we want input on, we might write a charge to NSAC telling them to study a situation and give us all of their guidance about it. And about every 7 years, we charge NSAC with writing a 10-year plan. And so the timing of that is what it is. It's every 7 years, you write a 10-year plan because plans change or reality changes. And so everything begins with a charge. It's very important that the charge is written in a way that addresses the question that we want answered. And so we, DOE and NSF, we wrote the charge that went to NSAC to develop a new long-range plan. And in doing that, DOE and my office iterated on the charge to make sure that it had the specific terms and scope and level of detail that we wanted. So we do that. After we give the charge to NSAC, we step back and they do their work, but we observe the process. So the DNP is very helpful in the long-range plan process because they organize town hall meetings in the different sub-areas of nuclear science. So the whole community is invited to these things, and DOE and NSF attends these because by observing those meetings and hearing the discussions, we become more aware of the level of intensity and commitment of the various sub-areas of nuclear science. So we do get a report at the end, and yes, we have a long-range plan report. It's all written up. But hearing the process and how the consensus was arrived at is really important because it gives us more context for the report. So the report is written, was presented and accepted, and gives context to the reviewers who I send proposals to. And it also gives context for my funding recommendations. However, the National Science Foundation, we respond to proposals. So we are not, our mission is not to accept a plan from an advisory committee and then execute that plan. Our mission is to further science and other benefits to society. So we respond to the proposals that come in. So what that means is some proposal might come in that wasn't even thought of when the long-range plan was proposed. And if it reviews well, I'll do my best to try to fund it, right? So it's a little bit different in that the long-range plan gives me the context. And so I would have to weigh that brand new thing with everything else that was really highly rated and prioritized in the long-range plan and say, is it really competitive with those other things? Because those other things were identified by the community as priorities. So the long-range plan gives me context, but I also have freedom to respond to new ideas that come up outside the plan.
That's really interesting. Yeah, it's kind of already answered the next questions that we had about how that, you know, affects your role. I didn't really ever think about the role that the NSF plays in the long-range plan. So yeah, that is interesting to hear about and how the long-range plan affects the NSF.
Well, and the long-range plan, it's absolutely essential for a community that need research tools that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, it's a big responsibility to spend the taxpayers' money on something like that. And you want to know that the community thinks it's got a high potential of having a significant impact. But it's research. And, you know, research, there is no, you're doing the research to find out what the answer is. And it might not be what people expect, but that's the nature of research. So it's very important for making those big expenditure decisions. That's for sure.
Definitely. I guess maybe some more of the specifics. What have you seen in the, you know, most recent long-range plan report? And how is that, if it hasn't already affected your funding decisions, how do you expect it to affect future funding decisions?
So I would suspect that the proposals that are submitted this December, if they are for efforts that are called out in one of the four recommendations, those proposals are most likely going to highlight that in purple and green and say, this is real. This was part of the, one of the recommendations of the long-range plan. And so this is an important thing because they want the reviewers to know that. So that's definitely going to have an impact on the proposals that come in. As far as the plan itself, sometimes people think that that first recommendation of taking advantage of all of the funding that's been invested is a boring recommendation. But I think what it communicates to me is that it's a way for the NSAC committee to communicate to Congress and the American people that the investments that they've already made in those facilities have important science that still is there to be gotten and that the community values that and seeks to complete those missions to get every bit of science out of the existing facilities that they can. So I think that first recommendation is incredibly important. The second recommendation about neutrinoless double beta decay was one of the recommendations in the previous long-range plan. It continues to be a high priority because it's so hard to do. It hasn't been done yet. And the EIC, what could be more exciting than trying to figure out where the mass and spin of a proton really comes from? So it's a very helpful long-range plan. And I think it's very clearly calling out those high priority things.
That's awesome. I think that's really good to know. And I totally agree. I think neutrino list double beta decay is very interesting. And I'm really excited about the EIC.
So when did you decide to become a physicist? And what was that journey like?
So I have always wanted to understand how things work. And I've loved math and science. So my mom is actually more handy than my dad was. And so she put a dimmer switch on our dining room light. And so I was in there with not with a screwdriver poking around, because that wouldn't have been very safe, because I probably would have marked up the walls. But so I was always there with her when she was fixing things. And I was really lucky in that I took high school physics when I was in ninth grade. And I think that's when I started to think about being a physicist. And one time in that physics class, we were working in groups, and the group I was in was stumped. And the other people in the group were in 11th or 12th grade. And they told me to go get some help from the teacher. You know, it's kind of like send the little kid over to talk to the teacher. And she happened to be a woman. And I clearly remember asking her some question. I don't remember what the question was, but I asked her this question. And she looked me in the eye and she said, "You are smart enough to figure that out on your own." And I was like, "Oh, I guess I am."
Oh, yeah, that sounds really interesting. I mean, those specific moments are really important, especially as a high schooler, to sort of impact your future career choices. Yeah, that's really cool. So what obstacles did you have to overcome in your journey of becoming a physicist, if any?
So neither of my parents graduated from high school, although my dad got his GED in the Navy. So my family always supported me. And, you know, it was like, whatever you want to do, you go for it. But they didn't quite get me. So I was what we now call a first generation college student. So I was dealing with all the hurdles of being unfamiliar with the bureaucracy, the application processes, and what I was getting into. I mean, I don't think going from high school to college is necessarily the same kind of phase transition that it is between being an undergraduate and a graduate student, but it was a big step. And one of the hurdles was I lived at home while I was attending college, because that was what was affordable. I wouldn't have been able to do it otherwise. But I remember getting up really early on a Saturday morning to prepare for a final exam later that day. Yeah, the place I went to did final exams on Monday through Saturday. And so there I was studying at the kitchen table at 4 a.m. And my younger sister snuck into the house after being out all night. And my mom heard her and she got up and they had this huge argument. And I just hunkered down and put my head in my books. So it was challenging getting through university and then moving away for graduate school. I married and had my daughter when I was a grad student. And that worked well for me because the group I was working with was flexible regarding my schedule. But one of the challenges is that my husband was earning his PhD in folklore of indigenous groups in Colombia. So he would go to South America for months at a time. And all I can say is thank goodness for good, affordable daycare. If there hadn't been this daycare co-op for students of the university, I don't know what I would have done. So that was challenging. I haven't had dangerous or hateful gender harassment or anything like that, but there have been issues. When I was a new postdoc, I had a lab. We were taking data, and it was clear that the photomultiplier tube on a detector needed to be changed. And so I went to the cupboard and got out a new tube and screwdrivers and stuff and started to go down into the area. And somebody looked at me, one of the other postdocs, and said, "Do you know how to change that?" I'm like, "I have a PhD in experimental nuclear physics and I built detectors and wire chambers. And yeah, I can change a photomultiplier tube." So little things like, and sometimes you just shake your head and let it roll off your back.
Yeah. Thank you for describing these experiences. I know the child care and everything is really important. And that's probably hard having your partner be away for long periods of times when you're working and trying to raise your children and stuff. I think people need to understand that it's the little things, you know, the thousand tiny cuts or whatever is the saying, that can kind of beat you down slowly. And so it's important that we be aware of things like that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. So you mentioned that you're very busy with the NSF and the long-range plan, but what do you do to relax when you're not doing physics and running these administrative?
I love going hiking. When I was a student, I used to backpack in the Rocky Mountains all the time. And I don't backpack anymore. I have transitioned to staying in cabins. But so I love being outside and I read a lot of murder mysteries. It's just brain candy.
Where are you located now to work with the NSF?
So the National Science Foundation is located in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. And we are, for the most part, back in the offices in person.
Yeah, that's nice in some ways, not as nice in other ways, but yeah. So are you within some driving distance of the Appalachian Mountains, surely? So is that where you stay?
Mm-hmm. Shenandoah National Park is nearby. So that's a good one.
Yeah, I went to school in Knoxville and I enjoyed hiking. So that's definitely something to think of in terms of long-term career is, are you somewhere where you can go hiking?
Actually, I had a question. How did COVID impact your job? Because you said mostly in person, right? So like for how long did COVID and everything impacted?
So in March of 2020, we had a panel all set for 19 people to fly into the area and meet in a meeting room and discuss 55 proposals. And within a week, it was like, nope, everybody's staying at home. And we didn't use Zoom. We used a different thing. We used BlueJeans. And we all managed. But for that first panel where people were working from home and not from the universities, not everybody had good internet. And that was a big challenge. And I think it continued to be a challenge for a lot of people to have good access to the internet. We just flipped. We did everything. All of our panel meetings were done online. And we moved as many proposals. We reviewed as many proposals. We funded proposals. But I know that the interaction of the panelists was different. You miss some body cues. You miss being able to catch somebody's eye when you have a question in your eye. You know, it's like somebody has a question, but you don't really see that they have a question. So you keep talking. And so that's not good. The panelists also miss being able to chat with each other during breaks. Very often people will be on a proposal review panel and end up doing research together a year later because they've shared ideas. So, I mean, we functioned, it's fine, but everybody, I think, really does like to do reviews in person. The other big impact about COVID, though, was the impact on the research and the research community. So the next year, I expected to also get about 50 proposals, but I got a fraction of that. And it's because faculty had to spend a lot of time learning how to teach online, and they weren't able to get into the labs. So they weren't writing proposals. So the research lagged. And the big concern at NSF was postdocs and graduate students. So if you're a graduate student and you can't get into the lab for a year, that impacts your career path. But if you're a postdoc position is usually for maybe 2 or 3 years. And if you can't get in the lab and get papers out for a year, that'll just tank you. That just ruins your career. And so Congress appropriated $600 million to NSF for COVID relief. And we intentionally used it to make supplements to carry graduate students and postdocs for an additional year with the hope of, yeah, it's an extra year, but at least you're supported for that year and you're doing some research. So that was a big impact from COVID.
That's really awesome. I had no clue that that happened with the big COVID relief going to the NSF, but I'm glad to hear, at least in this case, it really went to a good place. I was wondering, what advice do you have to undergraduate students or young researchers who are interested in becoming a physicist or just staying in physics?
The only advice I have is pretty trite. It's just go for it. If it's something that you really... So as my dad always said, that if you love your work, it's not a job. It's what you do. But it's always good to find mentors that you trust. And there will likely be periods when you just have to dig in and immerse yourself in something to really get it. And it may be hard, but it's going to be well worth it.
Thanks for this amazing advice.
I have to agree with all of those points so far. It has definitely helped me just to go for it and just to jump in sometimes.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. It was great talking to you.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, thanks for talking with us. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Great. Good. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Huiwin Lin. This episode was hosted by Bill Good and Kinza Hassan, edited by Esther Cohen Lin and Huiwin Lin. Thanks for listening.